Hello, and welcome to Science World. New research shows that humans and the potentially lethal disease tuberculosis have grown and evolved side by side. Scientists in New Hampshire say that they have found a link between an asteroid or comet impact and a global climate change event that took place nearly 13,000 years ago. And we'll learn about computer hacking, cybercrime, and keeping yourself safe online. This and more are coming up for you on VOA Science, Health, and Technology magazine, Science World. The origins of humans have been traced to Africa, and now so have the origins of tuberculosis. New research shows the evolutionary trees of both humans and TB have grown side by side. Joe DiCapua reports.
TB bacteria originated in Africa at least 70,000 years ago. That's the finding of a team of researchers led by Professor Sebastian Gagneau of the Swiss Tropical and Public Health Institute. But why study the history of TB?
At the end of the day, it's a certain kind of historic question, and there has been long discussions about where TB came from originally. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, the idea is that by learning from the past and how infectious disease evolves over time, this potentially could give us some clue about the future of the TB epidemic.
Gagneau says the evolutionary trees of humans and TB probably did more than just grow side by side.
I think that's a nice way to put it. Maybe you can even say one inside the other. Imagine where TB bacteria live, which is actually inside of human bodies. Yes, side by side, or one inside the other.
Studies are trying to determine why only 5 to 10% of the estimated 2 billion people infected with the bacteria actually come down with active tuberculosis. Gagneau says TB left Africa when humans did, about 65,000 to 70,000 years ago. Then, about 10,000 years ago, came the Neolithic demographic transition. It's the time when people started to develop agriculture and domesticate animals. But it was also the time when diseases jumped from domesticated animals to humans for the first time. Gagneau says for many years, it was assumed that TB took the same path, from animals to humans. However, research shows that TB in humans predates the domestication of animals. It's particularly adapted to live inside humans and cannot really survive on its own in the environment. There was another important development during the Neolithic demographic transition. Humans started to form settlements that were densely populated. It's an ideal situation for the spread of tuberculosis through the air from human to human.
Because of these changes in these human behaviors and numbers, potentially TB might have become more virulent in the sense of causing disease maybe more quickly or maybe a more deadly disease. It's true that TB is very deadly nowadays. So if you don't treat, it kills up to 50% of people who actually have active tuberculosis.
He says before settlements, in the hunter-gatherer days, perhaps TB was not as deadly.
Overly deadly would be a bad strategy for any pathogen because you might just kill off all susceptible hosts and you might end up with nobody else to infect. And so only once through this Neolithic transition, when more and more people were actually living close by, TB maybe evolved in a way to be able to become more virulent and take advantage, if you will, of this increasing number of susceptible people to infect.
After humans left Africa, they started to change in appearance as they adapted to their new geographical locations. TB also evolved, and now there are many different strains of bacteria that cause the disease. The strain found in South Africa differs from that found in China, for example. Africa, though, still has the greatest diversity of TB strains. Researchers hope that knowing the evolutionary history of TB will help in the development of new drug treatments and vaccines. Currently, the number of drug-resistant TB cases is growing. The knowledge may also help predict future patterns of the disease. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The U.S. space agency NASA is launching a new mission to study the moon. Suzanne Presto has more about what scientists hope to learn from the LADEE mission.
The Lunar Atmosphere and Dust Environment Explorer, known as LADEE, is NASA's new robotic mission. It's the size of a small car, and it'll collect data for 100 days as it orbits our moon. Scientists want to learn more about the moon's thin atmosphere because they think it could be common in our solar system. The knowledge could help them better understand asteroids and other planets. LADEE also will collect data about lunar dust, like its electric charge, density, and mass. The moon's dust is rough, not powdery like terrestrial dust, says LADEE project manager Butler Hine.
It works its way in equipment. So one of the questions about dust on the moon is an engineering question. How do you design things so that they can survive the dust environment?
And there's another question. Astronauts who landed on the moon in the 1960s reported seeing a pre-sunrise glow, and NASA wants to know if electrically charged lunar dust was responsible for it. It's been decades since a manned mission, so the timing is right, says LADEE program scientist Sarah Noble.
There's actually a number of countries, a number of private companies that are planning landings to the moon in the upcoming years. So now is a really good time to go and take a look at it while it's still in its sort of pristine, natural state.
NASA is urging amateur astronomers worldwide to watch for lunar impacts during the LADEE mission.
There are impacts hitting the moon all the time, and we want to know what impact those impacts are having on the atmosphere and dust environment.
Astronomers with iPhones can download a free application to share their observations with the space agency. NASA's Noble says something the size of LADEE hits the moon about once a month, and LADEE will do just that with a controlled crash at the end of its mission. Suzanne Presto, VOA News, Washington.
It's time once again for the Science World Quick Quiz. As you just heard, NASA is launching a new lunar probe called the Lunar Atmosphere and Dust Environment Explorer, or LADEE. For today's quick quiz, we want to know the name of the first lunar probe to actually reach the surface of the moon. Was it A, Pioneer 1, B, Luna 2, or C, Ranger 3? Think about it and see if you can come up with the right answer. We'll reveal the correct answer in just a few minutes from now.
You're listening to Science World, VOA Science, Health, and Technology News Magazine.
Japan's government says it will take the lead in trying to stem the leaks of highly radioactive water at the Fukushima nuclear power plant. The plant's nuclear reactors were crippled in 2011 by a huge tsunami generated by a devastating earthquake. Steve Herman reports.
Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe is vowing to spend whatever is needed to contain the ongoing disaster at the destroyed Fukushima reactors on the Pacific coast in the northeastern part of the country. Mr. Abe took steps after repeated leaks of highly toxic water at the site indicated that the plant's operator has not been able to sufficiently manage the cleanup. The Japanese Prime Minister says it can no longer be left to Tokyo Electric Power Company to handle the problems resulting from the contaminated water leaks. Mr. Abe explains that the government will have to be at the forefront with comprehensive rather than the existing ad hoc responses. One of them will be the construction of a shielding wall of frozen earth around the reactors to prevent contaminated water coming into contact with groundwater. Japan's nuclear regulator is expressing concern about the stability of the destroyed power plant amid revelations of freshly discovered water leaks. The initial amount of public funds pledged by the government for the cleanup equals $470 million. Kevin Mayer, a former U.S. diplomat who ran the State Department's task force on the March 2011 disaster, tells VOA that Japanese government financing is essential for the cleanup.
There's no way that a company like TEPCO, for the industry as a whole, can survive with tremendous liabilities that they're facing. I've seen estimates anywhere from a total of all those combined of 13, 14, 15 trillion yen up to $150 billion. $400 million or so additional money is essential, but it's not going to solve the problem.
Japanese officials contend that the water leaks at the coastal facility do not pose a threat to any other countries because the radiation will be diluted in the Pacific Ocean. But the closest towns to the plant, abandoned since the accident, are not likely to be re-inhabited for many years to come. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Scientists say they may have found a link between a dramatic climate shift nearly 13,000 years ago and a cosmic event. Science World's Bob Doty has the story.
This week, scientists at Dartmouth College in New Hampshire said they believe an asteroid or comet that struck the Canadian province of Quebec at the beginning of a period of global cooling may have played a role that led to the climate event. The Younger Dryas Statial, or the Big Freeze, was an abrupt, geologically brief period of colder and drier climatic conditions that lasted about 1,300 years and had far-reaching effects on both humans and animals. Big animals such as mastodons, camels, giant ground sloths, and saber-toothed cats all vanished from North America during this cool period. Humans who lived in North America at the time, known as the Clovis people, normally hunted the large animals, but after this extinction, they set aside their heavy hunting weapons and adopted a hunter-gatherer lifestyle, living off a diet of roots, berries, and smaller game. Scientists have long thought the Younger Dryas period was caused by a surge of meltwater from the North American ice sheet from the last glacial period. According to this theory, a great amount of fresh water from melted ice collected behind an ice dam, which suddenly burst, dumping huge quantities of fresh water into the Atlantic Ocean. The sudden water surge was thought to have shut down the ocean currents that usually move ocean water from the tropics northward. The lack of the usual northbound stream of warmer water then left the climate cold and dry throughout the Younger Dryas period. The Dartmouth scientists said that their research shows conclusive proof that an asteroid or comet impacted over the North American ice sheet around the beginning of the Younger Dryas period. But further investigation and study will be needed to determine just how the cosmic event is linked to the Big Freeze. Reporting for Science World, I'm Bob Doty.
Firefighters are battling dozens of blazes in the western United States. A new study finds that more wildfires are expected in the future, and they may burn across wider areas and for longer times. Roseanne Skirbel tells us more.
Fires in the western United States have gotten worse since the 1970s. Scientists at Harvard University School of Engineering and Applied Sciences looked at past weather conditions and wildfires to find out why. Atmospheric chemist Loretta Mickley is a senior research fellow and co-author of the new study.
In some regions, like the Rocky Mountains, really temperature is the driving force. But elsewhere, variables like relative humidity can play a role. If one year is particularly moist, for example, in the Great Basin, Nevada, Utah area, then that will foster a lot of vegetation growth. And then the following year, all that vegetation can feed wildfires and their spread.
The scientists then turned to a suite of 15 climate models based on the conclusions of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the leading international body for the assessment of climate change. On average, the models predicted increases between 2 and 2.5 degrees Celsius by 2050.
The findings for rainfall, which can diminish fire activity, and for relative humidity, we found only small changes, with some models predicting small increases and some models predicting small decreases in those variables. So we found that, as in the past, temperature is really driving the changes that we predict for the future.
Mickley says the calculations suggest the probability of large wildfires would increase by factors of 2 or 3, and that by 2050, the more than 4-month fire season would be 3 weeks longer.
If we just look at 1 month in the future, for example, the area burned in the very forested Rockies could quadruple. If we look at the whole fire season, we see increases more on the order of, say, 20 or 30% to 100%.
While air quality in the United States has greatly improved in recent decades in response to federal laws, Mickley says air pollution is an unexpected consequence of longer-lasting, widespread wildfires.
But these increases in wildfires could totally disrupt our efforts to clean the air. Last weekend, there was an area the size of some states in the eastern U.S. blanketed with unhealthy air over California and Nevada. And we call this increase in smoke an important climate penalty on air quality.
That penalty would be air that is twice as smoky as it is today. These findings, Mickley says, underscore the need for better forest management. But also, she adds, they send a signal to policymakers and the public to reduce fossil fuel emissions that are warming the planet. The study appears in the October issue of the journal Atmospheric Environment. Roseanne Skirbel, VOA News, Washington.
You have the right answer to this week's quick quiz? Well, let's find out. Since NASA is launching a new lunar probe called the Lunar Atmosphere and Dust Environment Explorer, or LADEE, we wanted to know the name of the first lunar probe to actually reach the moon. Was it A, Pioneer 1, B, Luna 2, or C, Ranger 3? The answer is B, Luna 2. The lunar probe launched by the Soviet Union was the first spacecraft to reach the surface of the moon when it was purposely crash-landed there on September 14, 1959. By the way, both answers, A, Pioneer 1, and C, Ranger 3, were lunar probes that were launched by the U.S., but neither one of them ever made it to the moon's surface. Thanks for playing along with us on this week's Science World Quick Quiz. We'll have another brain teaser for you again next week.
You're listening to Science World on VOA. You can also find us on the internet. Our new webpage and blog can be found at voanews.com/science.
As the internet has grown over the years, many people have gone from using the computer networking technology to look up information or send emails to banking, shopping, and conducting all types of official business online. Sensitive financial information constantly flows online and has proved all too tempting to criminals. That means going online can be hazardous to your finances if you don't take care to keep your data safe and secure. Since the internet is global in nature and can be quickly and easily accessed from virtually anywhere, cybercriminals have a convenient way to commit almost any illegal activity from any place in the world. Cybercriminals who take advantage of a number of technical weaknesses can burrow or hack their way into the internet to intercept all types of secured information or even plant destructive computer viruses and malware. According to security experts, one of the most valuable and important tools that internet users have to protect themselves from cybercrime is having a good password when logging into your favorite website. Bill Carey of the software company CyberSystems, creators of the internet password manager RoboForm, joins us for today's one-on-one segment. He talks about computer hacking, how to protect yourself from cybercrime, and how password managers, like his company's RoboForm, can help you keep track of all your internet usernames and passwords so you can create safer login information. Who or what are the most common targets for hackers?
Well, hackers by nature definitely want to try to get into your personal information. Some hackers are just trying to go after credit cards. There's a lot of people out there that can just use your credit card number and go to different websites and try to charge things, validate the credit card number, and then they'll be able to charge other stuff online. And then there's another whole group of hackers that will go after passwords. And once they have your passwords, then they can log into your accounts and get your personal information and, you know, do other things with your personal information once they have your passwords.
How serious is the problem of hacking?
I think it's pretty serious. You've seen a lot of stories on the news lately of different websites being hacked and, you know, Living Social being the latest one. But, you know, just about every month it seems like there's another big name that comes out that have, you know, anywhere from hundreds of thousands to millions of records that were accessed by hackers. And I don't think it's a problem that's going to go away anytime soon, just because more people are doing more things online and therefore there's more opportunity for the bad guys, for the hackers to go out there and get this information and to use it to their benefit.
Can you give us a bit of a profile of your typical hacker?
The hackers nowadays seem to be much more organized and in small groups and professional in the sense that they have professional equipment with professional hardware and software and, you know, more of like a group effort as opposed to just one person going at it alone.
How do hackers get a hold of passwords? I mean, how are they able to come up with someone's password?
There's sophisticated pieces of software out there that it's called brute force hacking. And what they'll do is they can run like hundreds and hundreds of thousands of attempts at a time sometimes to make guesses at what these passwords are. And periodically they'll just hit on one if a person's password is not strong enough or if they provided access. The hackers frequently are just using programs to try to crack what the actual password is.
So how can you tell if you've been hacked?
You know, that's a good question. I don't think a lot of people can proactively tell. A lot of times they wait, you know, we get alerted to these things when the company send out an email or you hear it on the news or something to that effect, or that, you know, maybe you see a rogue charge on your credit card statements. But a lot of times people cannot proactively tell that they're hacked until after the fact, until there's some type of clue that they get that gives them that information.
You find out you've been hacked, now what? What do you do?
Well, the best thing you can do, the thing you should do right away is change your password because, you're going to want to prevent re-access to whatever site it is that you've been hacked on. But the other thing, too, is to make sure that you're using different passwords on all the other sites that you access. You know, you don't want that hacker to be able to see what your email address is and what your password is for one site and then be able to try to access other sites using that same email address and password. That's one of the security things that I always tell people to do. Probably the number one thing you can do is to use a unique password for every website that you visit, because you're not necessarily going to be able to control companies securing your information. So hacking may happen, but at least you can control the damage that occurs by, you know, using a unique password for every website.
What makes up a good password?
Yeah, there's a lot of different tips and tricks and, you know, people's philosophies out there. But generally, the longer you make the password, the better. And so we just saw a study recently that showed, like, if you have a 6-character password, that can be cracked in as little as a couple of minutes. If you have an 8-character password with a mixture of upper and lowercase characters and sprinkling a number and a special character, you know, that could take 17 years to crack using the same type of technology as, you know, what cracked that 6-character password. So generally try to use a mixture of upper and lowercase letters. If you can, put in a number and a special character, and the longer you can make it, the better off you are.
Now, you just reminded me of my next question here, and that is, as hacking has become something that's become so common, many websites require unique and sometimes extensive login and password identification to get into their website. As a result, you wind up with literally several to several dozen usernames and passwords. One way to keep track of that is something that you've developed, and that's called RoboForm. Tell us about that.
RoboForm is a password manager, so it will remember all those strong, unique passwords so you don't have to remember it, and you'll have one password for the RoboForm software, and then RoboForm will log you into these websites automatically. So whatever browser you're using, any of the major browsers, RoboForm will attach to that browser and automatically integrate with that. And you don't have to do anything to set up RoboForm, really. You just log into your websites as you normally would, and RoboForm will automatically detect that you've just logged into a website and ask you if you want to save that login. And once you tell RoboForm to save that login, the next time you go to that website, that's when all you'll have to do is click on that RoboForm login that was created.
That was Bill Carey from Cyber Systems in Fairfax, Virginia. That's it for this edition of Science World. Thanks so much for listening. Before we go, we'd like to invite you to visit our new website and blog. The address is voanews.com/science. Along with program information, you'll find stories, links, and much more. So stop by and visit us on the internet. The address again is voanews.com/science. Science World has been produced by Bob Doty, and I'm Rick Pantaleo. Be sure to join us either online or on your radio next Saturday and Sunday as we check out the latest in science, health, and technology on Science World.